You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. Watch highlights from this and other Office Hours interviews on YouTube at youtube.com/Belfer Center. Arup sat down with Catherine Kluver Ashbrook, a former journalist who is currently the executive director of the Belfer Center's Future of Diplomacy Project and the newly created Project on Europe and the Transatlantic Relationship.
I want to start out with the basics.
Mm-hmm.
All right. How big is Europe? Because people say a lot of different things when they refer to Europe, and I'm not really quite sure what it means.
Well, at this point, as we're speaking in the summer of 2018, it's still a collection in terms of the European Union of 28 member states. Now, in June a few years ago, right about this time, the British voted to leave the European Union. So at some point over the next year, we'll be 27 member states. But the debate on what constitutes Europe in a wider sense has been a historic one. So there are a number of candidate countries right now within Europe that are looking to become parts of the European Union that are currently still outside the European Union. So the geographical definition of Europe doesn't necessarily overlap with the members of the European Union, mm-hmm. which is now an economic market of, you know, just over 400 million consumers and customers, if you will. With the United, in comparison with the United States, we're right about on par, give or take a few people, but we are one another's greatest trading partners in the world. The relationship across the Atlantic between the countries of the European Union writ large and the United States are the pillars of a security architecture from which both sides have profited over the past 70 years. They are the cornerstones of the international institutions that we think about when we think about the international system, from the United Nations to the World Trade Organization, to the European Union itself, a project that for decades the Americans very much supported. So there's a relationship that has existed for many, many decades of time and that have become, for many Europeans, but also for many Americans, the bone marrow of how they see themselves as international citizens and as how they work in the world.
Now, and you started this project because you thought something was up, right?
Right?
Otherwise, why would we need this project? What's the purpose? What's going on?
Well, the relationship between these two partners, if you will, they're allies within the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a slightly different composition than the member states of the European Union, because there's Turkey and others in the mix at NATO, and then again some EU countries that are outside of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that sort of secures Europe and that wider relationship. But that being said, we've had over time, as partners, political disagreements. Think only of the Iraq War in 2003 or earlier disagreements when France decided in 1966 to leave the military arm of NATO. So we've had our problems as, you know, interpersonal relationships mm-hmm. have the same, even between close friends. But this moment in time seems to mark a pretty radical departure. We've seen this over the course of the last, certainly, 6 or 12 months with a renewed gravity. And we share, in some respects, the same problem. So it would be odd to think that now wouldn't be a time where countries on both sides of the Atlantic pull together. And I'm thinking specifically of the weakening of our democracies, the fabric of our democracies, the threats into our electoral systems by outside actors. So there are things happening where you would think now would be a critical time for that relationship to hold. And yet, political tensions have emerged, systemic tensions have emerged that are beginning to put this relationship really on the brink.
So let's get into that, because on the one hand, you could say, well, maybe those systemic things are happening for a reason. Is this a slow erosion that it has some strategic depth to it, or is it ignorance? Are people who are at the top putting their political interest ahead of their national interest, or just otherwise are not aware of what's going on, how important things are?
Well, there are a couple things. The world has become a lot larger since the end of the Cold War. I think when the wall came down and the Soviet Union disintegrated the way that we knew it in the early 90s, the assumption was that the United States would be the ultimate international rule maker, right? The liberal hegemon is sort of the word that we think of in political science. And then, of course, things shifted. In the 90s, we seemingly had the threat from Japan, certainly on the economic side, the five Asian tigers, and that went away. And then since then, we've seen the rapid rise of China. We've seen the, you know, arrival of India on the international stage. And Russia has begun to play a role of sort of an international spoiler in the system. So the world has shifted. It's become much more proliferated in terms of the actors that feel that they can, you know, mobilize in and begin to set rules in the international system in the way that we didn't have it for 50-some years. And so the perspective that people are beginning to take are larger. The Germans, the Europeans have interests in economic relations with China, mm-hmm. in some cases that are of critical importance to them, but they also see China moving in and if you will, you know, curtailing market access in the same way that the Americans are feeling this. So there are, you know, tendencies to be breaking out of the corset, if you will, of what was once the institutional fabric that was focused specifically on a security challenge across the Atlantic. Back then, the Soviet Union. So there are those shifts. There are certainly, you know, political gains in the works. And we see the way that the U.S. president has thrown a spanner in the works or a spanner into this relationship really over the course of every international appearance he has had with European leaders. Last year, the G20 summit, last year, the G7 summit, his appearances in Brussels at NATO. Those were all instances where the U.S. president could sort of express his view of this relationship, which is that allies across the world, not just the Europeans, but allies in general, he feels, have been playing the United States for a fool and have been doing so for really the past 70 years and have been taking merciless advantage of the security umbrella mm-hmm. and the economic strength of the United States.
Is there any, does that argument hold any water at all?
Well, it really depends on how you begin to slice the onion. Now, of course, the security umbrella guaranteed to Europe right after World War II was critical to help European economies rebuild, right? Think not only of the security umbrella, but think about the Marshall Plan, the sort of idea that the United States would provide this aid, but in sort of what we might think about of benign self-interest. It was in the interest of the United States to invest in Europe, to not constantly be inviting crises or war that the United States would end up being dragged into. That was the experience of World War I and World War II for the Americans. So there was benign self-interest going on there. And what has happened is, of course, that gave, if you will, Europeans time, space, but also protection, particularly in the sort of held umbrella or in the bracket of the Cold War, to build out, in some cases, very successful, robust economies, very successful and robust welfare states. All of those things are true. And not challenged from the outside for a long time, Europeans have let some of their security investments lapse. Mm-hmm. That's not a new complaint. President Obama made that vociferously over the course of his administration. Previous secretaries of defense have made it vociferously. Mm-hmm. It's an old issue. And it's not to say that the Europeans haven't changed or committed to that. At the 2014 Wales summit in NATO, they said, look, within 10 years, we'll meet this threshold. Yeah. But here you have a president now, for instance, on the security component, who is very impatient and potentially rightfully so. I happen to believe that, for instance, the Germans could be doing a lot more for their own defense and need to be doing a lot more. So it's been heartening for me to see over these last few weeks and months, really, that some of that pressure has worked in as much also, and that deserves to be said, as the annexation of Crimea worked to focus European lenses on the fact that maybe it is time that Europe shouldered more of the responsibility for its own security, because if something happens, and the migration issue or Russia's incursions from the east have meant that a lot of the security challenges in the European theater have to be dealt by European actors. So we're seeing a very rapid tendency to want to catch up, which could make the president happy long term.
It seems like there's a sort of irony, because it feels like a slow erosion. It builds up pressure, We get an impatient president who then says, okay, like we're done with you guys. And then that spurs them into action. It's ironic because it's almost like that we've almost always gotten too far. Like the problem has already gotten too so bad. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And do you see, I mean, I guess that's a question. You see it as there have been issues in the past. There is a sort of erosion of these U.S. and Europe strategic interests. However, the furor over which Donald Trump approaches these sorts of issues, what you're saying is that's not really merited, although it has had a couple good consequences. Am I reading that right?
Right. I think we have to be very careful. I think the Europeans for a long time assumed that Donald Trump and what he was saying during the campaign, and truthfully what he has said since the 80s, along a lot of the beliefs that Donald Trump is voicing now in a very vociferous and strong way, the way that he's bypassing Congress on some of these trade advances that he is making, are all views that Donald Trump has held since the 1980s. And so First, the Europeans misread this president. They assumed that when he was elected, that, you know, nothing would endanger this sort of sacred relationship that is anchored in NATO, is anchored in the support for the European Union, is anchored in this strong relationship that institutions and constituents and ultimately the quote-unquote adults in the room would rein this president in. This president is not one to be reined in. So I think the first strategic mistake that Europeans made is they took the president seriously, but they didn't take him literally. Mm. And what we have seen, particularly over the course of 2018, is that this is a president who should be taken both literally and seriously. So that Europe's, if you will, catch up to try to figure out what are our responses, joint and individually, to this president, have been somewhat disjointed. Mm-hmm. And now we've seen some efforts, particularly in the defense space, but now also in the trade area, to really shore up what European interests are. And so that, oddly, is pushing Europeans toward a greater cohesion, despite all of the forces that are sort of being inflicted on the European Union, has many challenges from the financial crisis that they never have fully finished dealing with, the migration crisis they've never fully finished addressing. So Europe is challenged on the inside through sort of centrifugal forces, and now it's being pushed increasingly by the president. Yeah. So it's a very interesting dynamic to watch.
And that complicates, or it nuances this question of how the U.S. or how to strengthen the U.S. transatlantic relationship.
Yes.
Because if Europe is tearing itself apart from the inside, you know, one of the things you mentioned earlier was that this is now a point where we should have a stronger transatlantic alliance because of a threat to democracy. Well,
right.
Those threats to democracies are happening internally.
Correct.
Not to mention the United States, but also all across Europe.
Within Europe,
so
yes.
So where does that leave the United States if Europe is even skeptical of itself and of its own governmental systems?
Well, the problem with this administration really is that instead of the great tragedy is this sort of loss of morale in this relationship, the loss of symbolism, the loss of real understanding for the worth of this relationship, right? Those are critical signifiers. And what's happening now, and we see this in the announcement of the top State Department official in charge of Europe, A. West Mitchell, who gave a memorable speech at the Heritage Foundation a few weeks ago, where he basically said, look, this administration would like to see Europe be split apart. We're going to focus our efforts on Central Europe and on parts of Europe that have been traditionally not as close to the United States. Now, it doesn't take a, you know, benign interpreter to think, well, this again is something that the president said either himself or through surrogates throughout the campaign, is that he doesn't believe in the European Union. He much rather strikes trade deals with individual members, none of which is possible for countries in the European Union. The top trade negotiator is a European official. It's not an individual country member, if you will. So what we're seeing is sort of a strategic effort by the Trump administration to enhance the split that you're already talking about. Split Europe from within to an American advantage. And those developments, including some of the things that I mentioned earlier, those are really new. That is a really strong point of departure that was never part of the American security or economic philosophy.
It's a conscious strategy, is what you're saying.
It is, absolutely. This is something that is being hatched in the White House. But again, it reflects views that the president has held for a long time. Yeah. So there is a little bit of European naivete, or there was certainly, at least over the first sort of 4, 5, 6, 7 months of this administration. And the Europeans are now waking up to this harsh reality that they have to work on settling sort of their scores on the inside and quickly, and be putting up at least a robust defense or sort of an insulating political approach on a number of these critical questions toward the United States. And so for European leaders, this is a very, very, very challenging time.
And what do you see happening here? Because the Europe has always struggled with a sense of unity, a sense of, of course, historically, there's no question, but even after the advent of the European Union, not to mention the financial crisis, there have been these challenges, Brexit, et cetera. There are challenges to this sense of European identity. It seems to be held together primarily by France and Germany, and primarily sort of an economic unity that we don't know quite yet if it's translated to political and identity-based unity. Do you see that happening? I mean, a conversation in the early 2000s, I remember, was whether or not Europe could be its own force in international affairs. Mm-hmm. And right now, it feels too fractured to be a single unified force.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly fractured because populism has taken hold in not only new member states, sort of the member states that joined the European Union in 2004, though again, it's been a few years, but we still consider them new, but then also in the founding member states. Look only at the Italian government that has just come to power, which is a coalition of two populist forces who on paper nobody would put together, and here they are, making certain demands, particularly in the area of migration policy, almost against the tandem that you rightly mentioned, Germany and France. So I do think that the population or the citizens in Europe still feel very strongly that Europe is of incredible benefit to them because, and if you ran the Brexit vote again in the UK today, the Remain camp, so tell us the polls, would likely win, still by a narrow margin, but they would likely win. So I think the pain that sort of continental Europeans are seeing Great Britain go through as it extricates itself from the European Union, from the European project, is enough, if you will, to have dissuaged movements across traditional and the founding member states that have put sort of a split from the European Union or a real breaking apart front and center. Now, that doesn't mean that all of these political tensions that you bring up don't remain. They do, and they remain even between Germany and France. Now, we're speaking in June, a couple of weeks ago, and it'll be interesting to see how this comes down the pike over the next few weeks. The French president and the German chancellor met to try to get on the same page with these reform projects. So what do I see happening? Is you're going to try to, there's been an old debate about core Europe and the periphery. But to keep this together, I think that's really what you're going to end up seeing, which is to say, France and Germany moving much closer together, trying to really work through their differences on a number of things. Specifically in the financial reform agenda at the heart of Europe, but also on big migration questions for them to try to take the leadership together, and then bring others along. And so it's going to be a messy negotiation on a couple of questions. We've already seen Eastern European states sort of put their hands up and say, no, not with us, or it's not going to happen. So it will be continuously challenged from the inside. What complicates this is things that happen at home. Domestic politics will continue to challenge what one might otherwise map out as a negotiation strategy to keep the union together for someone like Chancellor Merkel or Emmanuel Macron. Both of them are challenged at home in different ways for different reasons. And so it will take, you know, what we might think of as statesmanlike leadership, sufficient perspective on a 30,000-foot level on the complexity of these problems, and a strong knowledge of how you bring a domestic audience along to support all the critical changes that Europe will have to make, you know, not only across the next year, but across the next 5 or 10 years.
I mean, you're an optimist. You think it can happen? You think
the genesis of the European Union has been rocky and it's been difficult. And there's been an overt focus on the economic benefits that membership in the European Union can offer. Poland is an excellent example of that. That wealth, if you will, or that economic prosperity hasn't been realized in all European Union countries for, you know, reasons of globalization, because the world has changed in the meantime. So I think what the European Union at the foundational sort of edge has to get back to, or even member states, is trying to figure out how Europe and the European Union can guarantee physical security and economic security. And if you don't achieve a narrative that's cohesive, functional, and bound in policy, then, to your point, you're going to continue losing European citizens in terms of their understanding of the worth of this type of collaboration and this very, very unique, historically unique, institution or set of institutions within the European Union. So much work remains to be done. I have followed this very closely, professionally and personally, throughout my lifetime. There have been many crises within this relationship, but I think by and large, people feel vested as Europeans. So I think there are sufficient numbers of people across the European Union who feel that it's worth putting their energy in to and, you know, supporting their leaders in these efforts.
And where does the project fit in? The, the project on Europe and transatlantic relationship. This is a project of the Belfer Center that is directed. I assume that there's a premise that it is a good thing to have a close transatlantic relationship.
Yes.
It's not just, let's just study Europe. You know, there is a direction that this project wants ahead. How do you fulfill that agenda? Is it just hosting conferences? Is it involving members of Congress? And what are the activities that you envision?
So a lot of things that we think about now, all of the leaders of this program, that includes our faculty chair, Nicholas Burns, it includes our senior associate, Carl Kaiser, it includes me as the executive director, are either born transatlanticists or strong believers in the benefit of this relationship. American security is guaranteed if the security perimeter of the United States is extended as far as possible. The number one asset that the United States has against a rival like China or even Russia is this strong network of allies founded in common values, founded in common morals, and a unity that had been borne out for 70 years. So we, all three of us, share a fundamental belief in that reality. Looking at the state of the world, I think that there are many things that across the transatlantic relationship we could be doing together. Answers toward the rise of China can only be found together. Answers toward the sort of incursion that we've seen by Russia or the international spoiler actions by Russia in all sorts of different spheres from the cyber arena right down to our electoral systems, I think, are best found together. Allies serve the critical function of exposing your blind spots in policy and the things that you don't know because of maybe your geographical location or your political makeup. So I think even sort of in the security arena, there's much that we can do together. But we are posing as societies on both sides of the Atlantic the same questions. What is the future of work in the 21st century? What is the future of education in the 21st century? How do we uphold some of the basic premises that have made us the West since the end of World War II? And so I think there is a whole layer of sort of questions that we want to look at as part of the program. We want to focus other colleagues here at the Kennedy School who are looking at these sort of more integrated components about the economic future of the West writ large that goes into questions of work and labor and taxation and technology. We want to draw their attention to this relationship so that we're building good relations across the university. But we also want to bring political actors into this conversation more actively, make it more clear to members of Congress what we could be losing here, though I think a certain league of them is already highly aware. Of course, all three of us come from a diplomatic and international political mindset. So it's critical for us to see how transatlantic diplomacy could be strengthened. So we're looking at it really across four work streams, looking at this sort of crisis in democracy, but also looking at security issues, looking at diplomacy and sort of international policy writ large, but always with the focus of where are the opportunities that working together could present better results, more effective results for peoples on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean.
And you mentioned that you have a personal interest in the transatlantic relationship, and this is because you're a dual German-American citizen. What's the best thing about that?
Well, the best thing is democracy. The best thing is being deeply enmeshed in two societies. I grew up with one foot on an American military base. My mother served for 42 years as a Department of Defense dependent civilian, teaching at high school in Germany. So the best thing are the languages, frankly, the deep understanding of societies and functionalities of societies. that only ever emerges if you know languages well enough. The passports offer,
Those are great.
They offer a lot of travel opportunities, but in some respects, you know, understanding deeply what drives democracies, what drives people, what brings us together and brings us apart, what drives us apart, being able to vote and exercise those rights is incredibly dear to me because I really remain rooted in both countries very much equally. And I think there's nothing that goes beyond that sort of ability to have that transference and really understand both societies deeply. So I, in my adult life, certainly, I've always understood myself as a translator, as an explainer, as somebody who works hard to elucidate the differences, but also to continuously underline the similarities that we share.
And talking about language, you said it helps you understand societies. Languages also are different ways of thinking in some sense. They're not just a translation of English to German. Are there differences? I mean, do you catch yourself either thinking, I mean, not literally in another language, but somehow approaching an issue differently?
It depends very much contextually. Now, I've been in the field of international relations almost since I can remember, but since my early days in college. But I think the way that language is framed, it limits, particularly in this area, in some cases, creativity.
Because of the jargon?
Well, because here we are at the Harvard Kennedy School where we stress the development of leadership. Now, the German word for leadership is exactly derivative or is part and composite of the title that Adolf Hitler carried through his entire time. He was the Führer, and leadership is Führung or Führungskapazität. And so
you can't just be talking about
so
that.
Leadership. Yeah. So that explains in part a difficult relationship that Germans have with the concept of leadership and being first in line. And that has manifested throughout the history of the European Union. They've always let sort of the French go first ideationally, even though the ideas may have been thought of in Bonn back then. But it was always useful to have the French say them out loud and the Germans pay for them. That has predicated how Germans think about their interests in the world, to even use the word interest. To allege that Germany might have global interests is almost like a slap on the wrist in German public policy discourse. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. Words matter. The way that you express them matters. And then that ends up positioning the kind of radius that you might have in acting in international relations. And that's particularly true for the Germans.
That is extremely interesting. If I could follow up, the Germans, so they, I mean, we're now 70 some odd years out of World War II. Most of the people who were alive back then, at the time of World War II, at the time of the Holocaust, are no longer around. There are still a few people who are kids or very young adolescents. But that still weighs on the German consciousness, what you're saying. It's still very, very present in the way they conduct international affairs. Mm.
No, it's absolutely true. I just spent some time with people who are coming up on their last year of high school in my own high school in Wiesbaden, Germany. And these are children who have only grown up in a time where interventions in other countries, be they humanitarian or predominantly interest-driven, have ended with terrible results. If they look back on their own lifetime, they know Afghanistan, they know Iraq, and they are seeing the humanitarian crisis that is the Syrian civil war. And to talk to them is to say, oh no, is to listen to students say, oh no, we shouldn't be interfering in wars all over the world, not even for humanitarian reasons. And that took me deeply aback because I had been raised in Germany under two very basic premises, if you will, in foreign policy. No more war and no more Auschwitz. And the first time for Germans that came home to roost in a very dramatic way was, of course, in the Balkan Wars. And when you saw pictures of camps where people were essentially being ethnically cleansed, that was so reminiscent of Auschwitz to Germans that public opinion was enough that the German constitution was changed so that for the first time since World War II, you could begin to deploy German soldiers outside of the physical parameter of what was then West Germany, but Germany as the Federal Republic. And so that, for my generation, generation was a sea change. And that meant for my generation that it was our duty to raise the conversation in Germany such that Germany would get more involved internationally and would see more of its responsibility. So now you see a generation of that's sort of my age and above that pushes very strongly in public discourse for a greater role and responsibility for Germany in international affairs far beyond the borders of Europe. And that's, in fact, what Germany is doing. And the international piracy operations off the coast of Somalia. But you're beginning to see a younger generation that's increasingly skeptical of that because they haven't seen what good interventions, either led by Americans or with German involvement, have done for the state of peace and prosperity in the world.
They're starting. So what you're saying, actually, is they're starting to forget.
They're starting to, yes, they're starting to forget, or they're not seeing things with the same sort of morality-bound compass that my generation is seeing it. And that, to me, frankly, was a shocking realization. Now, very small sample size, yeah. Very small group of people I spoke to. But if that is true across the board, then that's all the more, impetus for my generation to be even clearer about what Germany's responsibility is in the world and what Germany's relationship is across the United States to defend values that for 70 years we've almost taken for granted. They're no longer taken for granted. People are increasingly skeptical of what these values mean in practice. And that, for people in my position or for people at the Kennedy School, rising leaders that want to work in this arena, means that we have an even greater ask, we have a greater task, and we have a lot of work ahead of us.
You mentioned that you went to see your former high school, that you had been in Germany. Now, when you were in high school, that's when the Berlin Wall fell.
Yes.
What was that like?
It was a very confusing state of affairs when it first happened, because what we often forget, we think about this as just a historically happy moment, and in the first few months it was, and then when we got right down to the political differences or what that might mean, it raised a lot of critical questions. You might recall that many Germans felt that now was a time for Germany to be a neutral actor like Switzerland in the middle of Europe, which of course the negotiation team on the American side would have never seen happen. James Baker III and of course George H.W. Bush, that was never their intention, but you had a German chancellor who at the time was very much torn between these internal and external debates in terms of what could happen to his country. But in the first instance, it was a very hopeful moment. I had gone a number of times to East Germany to perform with my youth orchestra. And
it was some cross-cultural.
It was very jarring. And we forget what it meant to walk down streets in Berlin and run into a wall and see a continuation of the same houses on the other side, where people lived and were conducting their lives, who we knew very little about. And so for that to shift, and geographically, if when you drove over to the east, 89, 90, 91, a country that had been literally fed from an energy perspective off of this noxious coal, the entire country was gray. And it smelled terrible. In the sense that how, given the geographic proximity, the differences culturally were stark. Now, looking back all these years, a full generation of humans have been born and raised without the knowledge of the wall. I think Germany ultimately did a poor job of bringing these two sides of Germany together. For as much of the work that we did in the West around our historic understanding of our responsibility for the Holocaust and for, the two wars that ripped Europe apart at the seams, that was not work that was being done in the East. There were completely different foundational myths about what constituted
Education
yes,
was a big issue.
Yes, the foundation of Eastern Germany. And I think in the work of growing together, that was something that we as a society, that the Germans as a society, did insufficiently well. And we see that manifest today in some of the election results. We see that manifest today in some of the xenophobia that's particularly marked in certain
stronger
parts of Eastern.
Interesting.
Yes, much stronger.
What are they afraid of?
Well, and I mean, it's a very valid question, because the parts of the country that voted most strongly for the right wing alternative for Deutschland are parts of the country that have 2% migrants. So where that sort of reality is not actually lived reality.
Right.
But there are other fears that I think Western Germans don't fully understand. And that's all borne out from a process of reunification that I think ultimately, in hindsight, we didn't handle particularly well.
So this is a long, you see this as a having long roots here. This was not something that was, you know, merely a product of the economic crisis, which maybe made it worse, but it's something that has roots back 25, almost 30 years ago.
Well, I think in the actual reunification, you know, which I, as a, you know, young teenager was following only peripherally, but as a political scientist later on looked at very closely, you know, it was an annexation of the West by the East, with the West assuming that, of course, people who had been kept behind walls and divisions for their entire lives would want nothing more than bananas and Deutschmarks and freedom to travel. But it turns out, you know, that these people had developed their own values and morals and views of a political system and understanding of security.
Yeah.
And so what you saw then, you know, in the beginning of the 2000s was an incredible wave for what we called in German nostalgia without the N. Ostalgia, meaning to say a nostalgia for the East, for the ease and the simplicity of life in the East. Now, completely ignoring that that was, you know, a proto-fascist spy state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this longing for simplicity, you know, is built in for all of us who are challenged by globalization. And I think there was an insufficient understanding of how, for people who originally came from the East or were born in the East or were raised in that system, how that would refract in their political views and in the way that they perceive the world and in the way that they engage with each other, but specifically with the political system. And we're seeing that now as it's coming home to roost, making the Alternative for Deutschland the biggest opposition party in the German Bundestag. And if you had told me in 1989 that that would be the case in my country, I would have never believed you.
Well, this has been extremely interesting. Catherine, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you for having me.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.